Welcome to Bees Table Talk, the podcast in which we have great conversations about business and our economy. My name is Bee Kyle, President and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber, and I'm glad you've joined us. I always enjoy these. This is my chance to talk with leaders among us, doing great things within the community and within their organizations. My guest today is a new friend, chamber member, and leader within the state and the national business landscape. Michael Gore is the CEO of Catholic Charities of St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Michael brings with him a lifetime of service, most recently through his work as CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Twin Cities. Michael also had multiple stints within the Minnesota education system and spent 5 years as the COO of the Boston Public School System. We've been talking about traffic together this morning. He is a graduate of UW-River Falls. We got to talk about that. My brothers went there as well and played hockey with them. So we have to compare notes on that, Michael. And he earned his master's degree at Minnesota State Mankato. So, Michael, thank you for sitting down with me today.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to our conversation.
Well, and so introduce yourself to us, because you are a lover of Minnesota, and yet you have quite a wide history, where you come from and how you got here.
Yeah, so when I talk about my background, often I'm reluctant to talk about my history, but I think it gives things in the context of why I do what I do and how I got involved in public service. I've been a very fortunate person in my life. I was born and raised in South Korea. My father is African American and my mother is Korean. And I have never met my father. And, you know, being raised in that culture, in that community, being biracial was very tough for both for my mother and myself. So I think at young age, I quickly realized sort of challenges that both of us were faced. And I think my mother, more than anyone else, realized it pretty quickly. So she decided to place me in orphanage when I was 5 years old. So I grew up in this sort of institutional setting, an orphanage in South Korea that was designed for, I guess, for kids who looked like me and also kids with a physical disabilities. And it was a Christian-based organization, and their primary purpose is to have kids be adopted. And you stay there. Some kids obviously don't get adopted for a variety of reasons. Some kids do get adopted quicker. But I started, obviously infants are preferred, and when you adopt, not older child. So I grew up there until I was 12 years old in this sort of institutionalized setting in South Korea. Then, as I said, I'm blessed, and when I turned 12, I was known through my process that someone was interested in adopting me. And I said, me? Out of all the kids here, why me? And, you know, I'm 12 years old and there are younger kids and probably cuter than myself. Way back when, I had a lot of hair. I had an afro as a young kid. But I was blessed, and my adopted parents, both loving Gores, they lived in South Minneapolis. They couldn't have their own kids or their own, and so they decided to adopt. So they adopted three kids. I'm the last one they adopted. So they decided to go all the way across seas to South Korea in orphanage to identify this biracial kid who happened to be 12 years old. Now, what is the chance of that happening? You know, talk about hitting a lottery, right? So then, yeah, so the miracle happened and I got adopted when I turned 12 years old, came here. And, I'm so lucky and humbled by my parents' generosity and their love for what they believed was their sort of calling from God, which is help others. And they've decided to adopt. So as I say, I have two brothers and sisters also are adopted, but they were adopted when they were babies. And I happened to be adopted when I was 12 years old. So yeah, so that sort of created my belief and also an obligation that I have to my parents and to our community of service that I have to repay. And I can never repay my debt to my parents for adopting me and getting me out of that sort of that institution, because obviously, you know, I wasn't going anywhere in terms of life trajectory in that institution being biracial. And by being adopted, my life trajectory completely changed. So that allowed me to go to school, be educated, and learn English, learn different culture, and opportunity for me to go to college and go to graduate school. But I always felt like there was something that I had to do to really repay. So always been involved in public service one way or the other, out of graduate school or, my tenure in my work. So I got involved in education, started in higher ed, MNSCU, formerly known as MNSCU, I guess.
Right.
So worked there. Then I was recruited to work for Minneapolis Public Schools. By then, I was an amazing woman who has been my mentor, still is my mentor, named Carol Johnson, who's a superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools.
What's the time frame right now that you're talking about?
That was in 90s. Okay. We're talking about in the 90s and latter part of 90s, and she was a superintendent there and asked me to work for her in human resources. So I got involved in public education and in kind of the weird way through the back door, if you will, not through your traditional teacher from there moving on, but never taught in the classroom, but got into education through in terms of employee relations and managing people, understood quickly importance of great teachers in the classroom, but of course, is a product of Minneapolis Public School. And I understood exactly what that meant and how kids could benefit from wonderful teachers in our system. So
what was your master's degree in, Michael?
Public administration.
Okay.
Yeah. So I got involved in that. So that started my journey in education. So I worked for Carol for a number of years in Minneapolis Public Schools. Then she decided to take a job in Memphis. Then I worked for her in Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was it's a different world than Twin Cities, needless to say. Kid who grew up in South Korea, an orphanage, and lived in Minneapolis, and then going to Memphis is sort of very eye-opening and very shocking. But it was a great experience for me to understand issues of governance and politics and elections and whole sorts of other issues that I never knew that existed. I learned pretty quickly, and it was a great experience. Lived in Memphis. So did that for about 4 to 5 years there, and started in HR, then got into operations and became chief operating officer. From there, then I went to Boston. And the Carol Johnson, same superintendent, took a job in Boston. And she asked me to join her team in Boston and help her as a deputy superintendent. So I became her deputy in Boston and worked for her for a number of years. And she just is an amazing leader. And I loved her dearly. And I've learned so much from her being, what does it mean to be a servant leader, and being, and also having a true, true north, having a moral compass. And she's so focused on young people and what is right and what is wrong. And she was such a mentor to not just to me, but a lot of folks in our community, current active superintendents in our community, or former superintendents. We're all indebted to her. She has been our mentor for many, many of us and for many, many years. So I did that for a number of years in Boston.
How big is the Boston school system compared to the Minneapolis, to give us a sense of scale?
Yeah, so when I was working for Minneapolis Public Schools first time, we were the largest school system in the state. Now we're the third or fourth. Back then when I was working for Minneapolis, it was around 42,000 young people. Memphis, Tennessee, just to give you a scale, 120,000 young people, over 10,000 employees. Boston, 54,000 young people, about 6,000 people working in that system.
So Memphis, okay, that's kind of blowing my mind. So I want to get back to your comment about Memphis being eye-opening. I had no idea that the Memphis school system would be bigger even than Boston. I would have thought it would be, you know, you're this progressive thing. Wow.
Yeah, Memphis, you know, South has a school system that is really county-based, not city-based like us here. Okay. So Memphis was part of a Shelby County, and obviously city of Memphis occupied majority of Shelby County. But within that system, they had a number of small school districts, very separated by race and income. So
really?
you're talking South. So Memphis City Schools then eventually got to be Shelby County school system through lawsuits and all sorts of other things. But they occupy the majority of the space in the Shelby County. So, and the school system consists of 98% of the kids are African-American and about 100% are on free and reduced lunch. So you're talking about very poor school district and very large, predominantly African-American.
Yeah.
So it's a very different school system. And, you know,
you go to Boston, which is completely
whole different pace, right? Whole different pace and tone and tenure, but it also had its own separate unique challenges with the sort of, as you know, historical challenges of busing, that residue still existed, still segregation issues still was, you know, that was there. But Pace is an international city. Pace is quicker, faster. But it was a great city. I enjoyed very much living there. Well, that's where I met my wife, so I better like it, right? And it's a great city. And I learned so much from Carol and learned so much in the city of Boston. And Boston had a very unique system of education. Is what they call mayoral control city. So
mayoral control, as in the mayor. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So mayor controls the school system, control it not in a negative way, but mayor decides who gets to be the superintendent. And typically you have elected board members, right? Like Minneapolis, you got all these school board members are elected and they decide who get to be a superintendent. Not in Boston. The mayor decides. So it was a very different school system. Yeah. So and it's not unique. So like, for an example, Chicago has the same system. New York has same system. So it was a very different sort of school system in terms of design of sort of governance structure. And it has its advantages and disadvantages. So yeah, so my tenure has been involved extensively in public education. Then most recently, then I got involved in nonprofit space, coming from out of K-12, coming back home to start a nonprofit called Generation Next.
Okay, let's pause on that for a second. I just want to say thank you to your bride, because as a Minnesota mother of a son, I pray he doesn't find a lovely woman in Boston, because the chance of him coming back to Minnesota are less than if my daughter moved to Boston. It's not how that works, right?
Yeah.
Because your bride chose to embrace Minnesota, you know, we're obviously really grateful for that.
Took me a year and a half to convince her, though. So we got married, but we had sort of lived in distance. I came home, she stayed there, and the deal was I have to find a house of her liking.
And
that's how we got to really land on Brownstone. We found a Brownstone. Took us a whole year. They kind of agreed upon a price and everything else. And then another half a year for me to get involved in renovating the brownstone before she came over. Yeah, so it took me a long time to quarter back into, but she loves Minnesota now, and especially St. Paul. She really, you know, we talk about it all the time, Minneapolis versus St. Paul. She loves our house, but she loves St. Paul for all its charms and all the things that you experience in St. Paul, but also historical charm of the city, and what it represents. So she loves St. Paul very, very much.
You know, they say that St. Paul, and I find this to be true. I've spent a lot of time on the East Coast. I lived on the East Coast for a number of years, North Carolina and New York. And so that's my favorite part of the country is the Eastern Seaboard. And I've heard it said that St. Paul is the westernmost East Coast city.
Yeah.
So I feel really aligned with Boston. It's one of my favorite cities, as is Charleston for architecture, right? And Minneapolis is the easternmost West Coast city. And there's just that feel, and it's kind of fun that they come together here. So did you know that our market has more antebellum homes than any other city in the country?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, really? Right? Because in the South, so many of the architecture of the Civil War era and earlier was destroyed, of course, during the Civil War. And up north, in Minnesota, St. Paul specifically, has really focused on retaining a lot of its old architecture. And of course, Minneapolis is a beautiful neighborhood as well, like you found. So it makes sense to me that your wife would feel at home here because it feels a little bit like that. So that's really nice. I'm glad that she enjoys being in Minnesota.
Yeah, she does. You know, and we travel often into East Coast. And then month of July, she spends her time with her family. So she spends whole month of July in Boston, Rhode Island area, where she spends time with her friends or her family. So yeah, so try to split time as much as we can. Yeah.
Well, and she's, you know, being an East Coast girl, she's got to have a sophisticated palate. So you had indicated when we were chatting that you like to cook. So both little foodies, as I understand it.
Well, listen, you know, one of the great things about living in East Coast, especially Boston, is, you know, you have access to so many restaurants and food, and you don't have to travel very far. So when she moved here, she had one request, which is two. One was finding a great pizza place, and second was finding a great Thai restaurant.
Oh my goodness, Thai is my jam. Yes, yeah. We had to compare notes on that.
So we traveled everywhere for your pizza, right?
Yeah,
so,
but you got to know, is it Chicago pizza or is it New York pizza? I mean, it really depends on your style, right?
Yeah, exactly. So she has a very particular style she's looking for, and from being from Boston. So we have visited every possible pizza joint you can think of. And, you know, Minnesotans love pizza. You know, you got all these different type of pizza. Finally, that we have landed a restaurant pizza place in St. Paul. Yes, Big River Pizza, downtown, lower town, St. Paul.
I know Big River Pizza.
Yeah, is our preferred site. And we love Steve, the owner. And so we go there frequently and listen to music and eat pizza. So, yeah, so that took us a whole year to find that. And then once again in St. Paul, I visited all sorts of Thai restaurants.
Yes.
So we have found only there's one Thai restaurant that both of us can agree upon that we think we like the menu and the food and the quality of food itself is Ramit Thai on St. Peter.
Oh my gosh, it's fabulous. Yes. Well, okay. So that's really good. Have you tried Owen's Kitchen on Snelling?
Yes. I have.
That's our place. Ramit
Thai, your place?
Close second. I got to.
Yeah. That. Yeah. So we like Ramit over others. And so that is our preferred Thai and pizza. Awesome. So, you know, your comfort food, the things that you are used to, but you know, we love St. Paul and for all the great restaurants that it has access to. Right. I mean, we love the Meritage or St. Paul Grill and then when we're in the mood to, you know, drink a little and eat food like Moscow on the Hill, you know, so those are the things that we love. Yeah, we love very much. And then we like to cook our food. I like to cook. And I think it's sort of is a very therapeutic for me because just the course of what we do, what I do, I should say, you know, I don't get to see something that is created and get immediate feedback from someone saying, yes, I like it or I hate it. It takes us a while for me to get that feedback in terms of how we are doing or not. Yeah. So for me, it's one that gives me a sense of accomplishment. It gives me immediate reaction, reward. So, and I enjoy the process of preparing and sitting down and having a glass of wine or some other forms of alcoholic beverage, listen to music and cooking and just sitting, having someone there and cook and talk and enjoying it and saying, well, that worked out or that did not, because I have a critic in my house. So let me know, thumbs up or thumbs down. And so, yeah, so that I enjoy that part of what I, you know, our relationship and food very much.
I totally get that. I'm a gardener, but and for the same reason, you know, the work that we do is such long life that you want to be able to lose yourself in something in the moment and know you're going to feel good about it when it's done. That is absolutely I'm totally tracking on that.
Yeah.
Well, so let's go back to what got you back to Minnesota. You had mentioned briefly that you started an organization called Generation Next.
Yeah. So when I was in Boston, Carol was contemplating about retirement, and I was coming out of K-12 back-to-back-to-back, very intense, lot of challenging issues, and I felt like, oh, I need a breather. I need a little time or respite. But I always thought God had a plan for me. I thought God already had a plan in terms of being in K-12, but I just needed a little bit of time off. Plus my mentor was going to retire. I needed time away. At the same time, then you had folks from Minneapolis saying, hey, we are creating a new nonprofit. We would like you to come back home and start this nonprofit and call Generation Next. I said, what is Generation Next? I've never heard of such a thing. So it was, you had a lot of elected officials. Mayor Coleman at the time was on the board, mm-hmm. R.T. Ryback and all the business leaders. So they were concerned with sort of, still same concerns exist, the outcome of two urban school districts, Minneapolis and St. Paul, in terms of their student performance. And they also have figured out collectively in business community, we're spending over $70 million per year for grant purposes, funding programs. If you add it all up, is around $70 million on top of the allocation they get from their, from the state or local tax levy. So all of the business leaders and others got together saying, are there a way for us to pool our money and figure out what really works in K-12? And that way that we can have sort of greater impact for both Minneapolis and St. Paul. So what they then created this thing called Generation Next, which is the model came out of Cincinnati. There was a Cincinnati, Strive organization out of Cincinnati. It was doing this similar work, which is sort of getting all the funders together, identifying high quality program, seed it and fund it continuously for a period of time, defund programs that are not really working for school systems. So that was a design, an idea, and they wanted someone to sort of take that idea and create this sort of new nonprofit. So that was my first experience into this nonprofit space called Generation Next, which I had no idea what that was all about. And I had no idea what the nonprofit, how to run a nonprofit, because I was so used to K-12. I remember my first month, I was so, so depressed because I was so accustomed to, as a deputy superintendent, 24/7, the phone rings all the time. And this defines who you are as a leader. When I started this Generation Next job, my phone wasn't ringing at all. I was done by 4:30. Then I look around like, what am I supposed to do with my time? Like, no emergencies, no chaos. Nothing is happening other than sort of you're done. Now you got to go back to your apartment in St. Paul. And then I'm looking around saying, what am I supposed to do with all this time? So I was so, this space really created something that I wasn't used to. And I was so deflated because I was so accustomed to sort of this sort of energy of crisis, emergency. And
gosh, I totally am connecting with you on that. I totally get that. It's very, when it stops, you're aimless. Like, you need to reset, but you feel.
It's very addictive. Adrenaline you get from all the chaotic things, you're managing thousand things and you're stressed out, but it's part of, that's all you know. And it's just been who you are for many, many years. And all of a sudden someone took that away from you and you did it to yourself. No one asked you to do it,
right.
But you just didn't realize the consequences of that action until you are so, and so it took me a very long time to dig myself out of the hole of this space. So I did that for about less than a year or so. Then during that time, Minneapolis Public Schools was having a number of different challenges. I just like always seems to me Minneapolis Public Schools always faced with challenges. the perennial issues. And so at the time, there was a superintendent called, her name was Bernadia Johnson, not Carol Johnson, Bernadia Johnson. And Bernadia and I are very close friends because both of us work for Carol in Memphis.
Oh, wow.
And when I first time when I worked for Minneapolis Public Schools, Bernadia was a principal in school called Hall Elementary, and she would always have issues calling HR, and I would always help her. So we built a relationship, and we knew each other. And so, you know, and so anyway, she was asking me to come join her team as her CEO. I said, well, I don't even know what that is exactly. And at a school system, you're the superintendent. You cannot have a CEO. You cannot have two masters. That doesn't make any sense. And plus, I just got done with Boston. I'm not interested in, I need a time off, and I'm not interested in K-12 stuff all over again. That's why I took the job of Generation Next. So anyway, moving forward fast. And then, you know, you have other folks, RT Radback and other folks have encouraged me to take the job, help the Minneapolis Public Schools. So I was there for 3 years. Meanwhile, when I left, RT became the executive director of Generation Next. And I accused RT. Only reason that he asked me to go to Minneapolis so he can find his landing spot for himself after his mayorship. But RT was there for about a couple of years, and then, you know, he's in Minneapolis Foundation now. Right. So I did that for 3 years in Minneapolis Public School as a CEO, then eventually becoming interim superintendent. And then that, when I was done with Minneapolis Public Schools, and I got into the nonprofit of, Big Brothers Big Sisters, they were looking for a CEO. I became their CEO for 5 years. And I love what I did in terms of working with young people, providing mentorship. You know, and I finally realized also, you can make a difference impacting young people's lives outside school system. You don't have to be inside a school system to really help young people. You can be part of outside partner. And some days I think I can, you know, I could make a greater impact on lives of young people than inside, because all the bureaucracy, all the challenges that are faced in K-12. So I did that for 5 years while I was doing it. Then, you know, lo and behold, a Catholic charity saying, hey, we're looking for CEO Tim Marks is retiring, and we're looking for a CEO. Are you interested in being involved and being interviewed? And I was pretty clear. Listen, I've been involved in young people's lives. Other end of the spectrum, right? My job is to prevent young people from being clients of Catholic charities. We want to provide the life chances where they're successful. So you're talking about the extreme end of our sort of continuum. But, you know, as I said earlier, you know, I'm so fortunate that I got adopted, and I understood at a very young age what it means to be homeless or being hungry. And I was afforded the opportunity to be in a institutionalized setting, or for that matter, being adopted. So I know what that means to really be loved, and how that could fundamentally change one's trajectory. So that gave me inspiration to say, yeah, opportunity for me to lead this amazing organization that I knew little, but I knew that their mission, I love their mission. And I especially love Catholic social teaching, the common good, and opportunity for me to serve the community. As I said, I have such a debt that I have to repay for my parents and the community that adopted me, embraced me as a young person. So I felt like this was my calling to be involved in a completely different space, and allow me to see the other part of our equity challenge that we have in our community. And what can I do in the back end of it in a way that I can make an impact in lives of people that are faced with homelessness or unsheltered? So it's a completely opposite view in the spectrum of the work, and I'm used to working in the front end of the challenge. Now I'm kind of in the back end of it, and making sure that I do whatever I can to improve lives of clients that we're serving every day. So yeah, it has been challenging at times, but it has been such a rewarding experience, and I have amazing team of folks, amazing committed staff. During COVID, they show up. You know, we don't close. We're 24/7. Clients need help. So I've been blessed for past year and a half to be part of Catholic Charities community.
Well, you know, one could argue that the work of Catholic Charities is more important than ever. And particularly during the pandemic, you know, your work was, and people experiencing homelessness have been front and center in terms of the social issues, and the most obvious example of the social issues we're struggling with, right? And so, and you're uniquely prepared for the role you're in. So how are you seeing your work evolve, and, you know, what's your vision for the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I must admit, the advice I would give is that never start a new job as a CEO during pandemic.
We invited our executive reception last time we had was during a pandemic, and you were part of it. And several folks who were honored that year were transplants during, right? Yeah. So yes, challenging.
It was a challenging year in a variety of different ways for me. And as you know, we talked about sort of, you know, we're middle of pandemic, starting a job, everything is virtual.
Yeah.
It has been very challenging. And then I'm on the heel of coming on board as a CEO of an organization that had a long history of phenomenal leadership, a guy named Tim Marks.
Yeah.
Who is now my
mentor.
Quite
a legacy.
Yeah. So yeah. Coming in on the heel of his legacy in terms of the work, and coming into a new space, right? So coming from someone who has been involved in education, not in housing space. So a year of a quick learning, if you will, and building a relationship through Zoom and otherwise has been very challenging, and trying to create a common culture in our organization and building a team is very, very difficult during pandemic era. But that being said, I mean, it's clearly has stretched me as a leader, and helped me grow tremendously. And I think it helped me from, you know, my experience being resilient and being adaptive in terms of situation, really helped me to figure out how do I manage the work, and also trying to shift the paradigm of our organization. And to answer your question, historically, our organization has been, building capacity in our community because there was a need for, shelter, emergency shelter or transition housing and permanent supportive housing in our community. So my predecessor has been working really hard and working very effectively to increase the number of shelters and capacity within our organization. That also created an opportunity and challenge. So my job as a CEO then is, how do we then take that and leverage it in a way that we can truly make a difference in qualitatively? So now that we are almost done expanding our footprint, now we're sort of have pivoted away from expanding footprint to really changing the client's experience with us. Historically, we've been providing sort of shelter and food, right? So basic stuff. And I think one of the things that I've talked to our team about is that is insufficient. We need to go from sort of this sort of notion of basic needs into improving their lives in their stay with us. How do you improve their quality of their stay within Catholic Charities, so we can begin to see that we are making a difference in lives of our clients. So we have now been working very strategically, identifying key strategies to really transform our work into more of a quantitative than quantitative to qualitative, meaning historically we measure our success, number of meals that we served or how many beds we're managing. Those are very important metrics, but is insufficient defining quality of our client stay. Once they walk in into our building, We want to make sure their stay with us is not just surviving, but thriving in our care. So we're going from the notion of surviving to thriving. And sort of we are redefining what that means exactly for our individual clients. And also to the extent we're saying, here are the minimum guarantees. Yeah. If you're walking into Catholic Charities, this is what you're going to get, regardless of which building you walk into in terms of our shelter, our services. So there's a transformation that we're taking right now and moving forward in our work in more of a sort of improving quality of our work. And then in order for us to do that, we need to be much more collaborative, recognizing that we need partners at the table. Catholic Charities cannot do all the work by itself, nor should we. We need to recognize high quality partners and bring them into our space.
Have you thought about the parallels from where you began to where you are now? This idea about creating a safe place to be while preparing for them to leave, that's the intent, and that there's some fascinating life parallels about where you started and how you're serving people today.
Yeah, you know, just how my life in terms of, you know, how, and, you know, looking back, how lucky I am and how lucky I am that I was in that institutional setting that allowed me to, even though it was challenging, allow me to sort of get into a space to thrive, right? Being adopted. And then also, you know, that allowed me to then get into K-12, where that sort of my learning from K-12 can also then improve what we're doing in Catholic Charities. For an example, we make sure the kids will walk into our building when I was in education. There's minimum guarantee. There are standards which you have to meet, right? So in order for them to graduate, why can't we create a same sort of standard in our clients? When they walk in, there are standards which we have to meet, they should expect in order for them to not rely on Catholic Charities. End of the day, the goal is for them to not rely on us. It's not to house our clients forever and ever. Our goal should be rely on us, then you then minimize relying on Catholic Charities. You're self-sufficient. You're graduating from Catholic Charities. How do we do that in a very impactful way and preparing our clients to graduate from us?
That's a beautiful trajectory. Yeah. You can see that beautiful thread that runs through your life and your job so that you can really feel grounded into your priorities and your value system. I just think that's really powerful.
Yeah. You know, I truly do believe that we have such a wonderful mission and vision as Catholic Charities, and that our role in our community. And I think that sort of Catholic social teaching of common good, how can we improve lives of our residents? And then one of the things that we work on in our organization is why we do what we do, not what we do, but why do you do it?
Yeah.
Why do you work for Catholic Charities and why do we do what we do? You know, it means that we value every person coming into our building. There's a worth, there's self-worth. We have to value that and honor that. And how do we provide high quality services? How do you look at a client's walking in? Not as here's someone who needs shelter and they're lucky to get Catholic Charity services, but they have a right to thrive in our community. And how do we create that right circumstances for them to thrive? And how honor we are, we should be honored for them to walk into our building because they feel like this is a safe space. So it's sort of changing our mindset, paradigm shift that we're working on as an organization.
Well, I feel like we're very lucky to have you in that position. And we're running out of time here. So which is, you know, we can invite me over for a meal in your beautiful home and I'll drink some vino with you and I'll give you my immediate input on your food. Trust me. And we can continue talking. But before we go, this is a question I ask every time I talk with someone, because I'm not a career chamber person. My background is military, private sector, spent some time in economic development, and now I'm leading a chamber. And so my question always is, your scope is just so much broader, right? Our job as a chamber is to serve the region, serve the business community within the region. And so I want to know, what is the value from your perspective of a chamber of commerce in service to your work?
Yeah, you know, in every community, every chamber or every business, I think one of the things when, in order for us to attract business into our community, you got to provide why they should move into St. Paul or Ramsey County or Minneapolis. And that defines sort of quality of life and how we treat our, to me, the defining quality of life, one way we can look at it is how do we treat our most vulnerable community members? Why we, I think is important that chamber and all of us need to sort of be aware of this space is because I think it defines who we are as a people and humanity of our organization and for our community that
Mahatma Gandhi talks about that, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I think it defines the community's value in terms of how we connect with the most vulnerable community members. And we are in a space to serve those folks. Mm-hmm. And we know that we're not going to be able to do it ourselves. We have to have partners who are also willing to contribute, collaboratively work together to provide a safe space for our community members who are needing a temporary assistance. Mm-hmm. And I think it defines who we are as a community. And I think one of the reason I think be your work in chamber in St. Paul and surrounding community is a preferred site is because of how we treat our most vulnerable community members, because that mm-hmm. defines our values and our morals. And I think that that is a part of way that you can track businesses and convince people to relocate their business into our community because the fact that we have safety net for our most vulnerable community members, and there are ways for you to engage to provide services, way to engage for you to volunteer, for you to see that there's a value of common good in our community. Mm-hmm. We share that sort of thread, connecting tissue of the value. And I think that is so important for all of us. And I truly believe that all of us have a role to play, either individually or collectively. And I hope that you, as a part of chamber, our chamber members see the connecting tissues. You might be, you know, manufacturer, or you might be selling services in other extreme, but the reality is how we treat other vulnerable community members is how we define our community collective value. And that mm-hmm. is so important for all of us. And I want to say thank you very much for work that you do to make sure people are aware that, you know, a part of Chamber's work is providing those connections, awareness.
Right.
And
value. Connective tissue. I really like that. Yeah, I like the idea of the body. I mean, that really resonates with me too.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. And unfortunately, run out of time. I wanted to thank you again for chatting with me. Appreciate your time, all that your organization is doing. I appreciate your heart and how you approach your work. So thank you for the courtesy, Michael.
Thank you so much for allowing me to speak with you and engaging. And I hope to sit down and have a meal and for us to drink and talk about our common space.
Oh, I love it. I look forward to it. And thank you for joining us for Beast Table Talk. We have more conversations in the weeks ahead, like this one, speaking to business leaders in the greater MSP region and hearing from them on how their companies are adapting to the new normal ahead of us. Thanks to all, and we will see you in the trenches.